Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Well, there's never a bad time to make a financial fresh start. It makes sense to review your money managing and your money start for the new year. When tax forms, aggregate income information, and year-end summaries from credit card issuers make it easy to review annual spending patterns. Life is much easier when you have a solid financial plan, and being good with money is about much more than just making ends meet. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, and we welcome listeners of the West Side. Money can't buy happiness, but it can bring a sense of security if it's managed well. Without handle on money management, it can feel as though your life is one step away from a financial cliff. If you're concerned about your personal finances, you're not alone. One in four Americans say they worry about money all the time, and about half of the Americans say they are bad at managing it. Among the mistakes, they save too little or maybe too much. They buy the wrong amount of life insurance. They leave sums of Social Security benefits on the table and pay more taxes than they should. And because financial planning can seem difficult, many people make incredibly important decisions like getting married, deciding to have another child, or retiring early without knowing the true costs of their choices. These aren't small decisions. Today, we delve into the do's and don'ts of money management with the help of a familiar voice to Wisconsin Public Radio, Kevin McKinley, owner of McKinley Money LLC, an independent registered investment advisor with offices in Madison and Eau Claire. He's also the author of the book, Make Your Kid a Millionaire. Kevin, welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hello, Rick.
Hello, Kevin. We're happy to take personal financial questions from our listeners as well. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742, or by emailing ideas at WPR.org. Kevin, I'd like to start talking about budgeting. Many people don't budget. Maybe it's they don't want to go through all the what they think will be a boring process. Maybe they're afraid what they'll find and don't know how to start. Help us understand the value of budgeting.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that topic up, and especially first, Rick, because you know I've been a financial advisor. This is my 34th year of doing it, and so I'm starting to get the hang of it. And one of the things that happens when I work with clients individually, we have them fill out a little questionnaire in advance, and that just talks about their general financial situation. And when I get the results back from them, the first thing I look at is not how much money they have or how much money they make or where it's invested. I look at what they spend, because that is the single most important factor in every single aspect of financial planning, not just retirement and college, but also how you should invest, how much risk you need to take, how much you have to take. And it's difficult, especially in inflationary times, when you go to the grocery store and what used to cost, $100 for weeks of groceries is now $130. It just seems like spending has to go up. But it's a lot easier to spend less money than it is to make more. And so that's why budgeting and tracking every single dollar that you spend and then trying to reduce it is the single most important factor to not only determining your financial decisions, but also to reaching financial independence.
Well, let's walk us through a basic budget plan. How do we set it up and where do we go with it?
Start with the fixed expenses, and that's usually rent or a mortgage payment. And then you're going to have utilities. Often people have a car payment or something like that. And usually one of the interesting things when I see these budgets is even people who don't have a car payment, a lot of times that's because they're wisely driving an older vehicle, but they're also then have to plan for variables in terms of the expenses of maintaining that older vehicle. So it seems like we get out of, we make that last car payment, then all of a sudden there's a $450 expense on top of on top of gas and insurance and everything like that. And then food necessities and things like that. And the average expenditures in an American household right now are somewhere around $4,500 per month. The great thing about, you know, our listeners here in Wisconsin and in general and the Midwest more so, is that you can have a very nice life in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, on a relatively low dollar amount. So a lot of times people who are making money in this state feel like they're not getting paid enough, especially if they have friends or relatives who live in Chicago or New York City or something like that. But the money in Wisconsin goes a lot further for that. So after you get those basics covered, then you have to start prioritizing your dollars and where they need to go in terms of debt and retirement and saving for college and all those other fun things.
Okay. So we've got our budget. We've been working through a plan. We have a basic budget, average family, let's say four. It's winter. It's below zero. Your furnace goes out. Unexpected expense. Now, from what I understand and what I've heard you say before is that we should always have an emergency plan, an emergency fund, if you will, set up for those kinds of expenses, things that we don't expect, things that come out of the blue. How much do you really need to set aside, and how do you start?
Well, there's two different components of an emergency. One is for the ones that you just mentioned. And for that, you know, I actually believe in keeping a credit card available and hopefully keeping as much room on the credit card as you possibly can. People who, and especially those of us who, you know, who were raised by farmers or raised by people who were raised by farmers, somewhere along the line, there's an agrarian strain to our heritage that taught us that debt is bad and all forms of debt are bad. And that's not necessarily true. Debt is kind of like a chainsaw in that if it's not handled correctly, it can be an extremely dangerous. But if you know what you're doing and you treat it safely, it can be a really effective way to cut down a tree. And that's the same thing with debt. So if that's the case, I'd like people to have a credit card established that they just only use for emergencies. And obviously, winter in Wisconsin and a furnace going out counts as an emergency. And then after that, it's good to have at least 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses set aside. And that's not so much about a furnace going out. That's more about either you lose your job or you can't work at your job anymore because you have to provide caregiving for somebody. And that safety cushion of 3 to 6 months can get you through until you figure out what your next steps are going to be and how you're going to start paying those living expenses. And then, ironically enough, by having to set up a rainy day fund of 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses, that also forces you to calculate what your monthly living expenses are.
Okay. Now, I've also read about something called a sinking fund. Can you explain what that is? In relationship to unexpected expenses, that kind of thing.
Well, in terms of saying it's kind of I'm not sure the context to which you are referring, but in terms of saying, hey, this is something that once we get this base set up of this rainy day fund, then we can start using money above that for bigger goals like saving for retirement, saving for college, and even taking vacations.
Okay, now. People starting a family, a young family. One of the first things that folks think about is the kids that are starting to get a little older is saving for college. What are some of the options that people have right now, or that you see forthcoming in order to save for college in a good way, starting early?
Well, it's a very noble and understandable sentiment that you have this kid, and not only do you have to provide for this kid today, but you start worrying about providing for this kid 10 or 20 or 30 years from now. And when you are saving money for a child, I like to adopt a strategy of kind of like what the flight attendants tell us when they're giving this the pre-flight spiel that nobody ever listens to, is if you're traveling with a small child, put your own mask on first and then put the child's mask on second for it. Right. And that's really, unfortunately, what we have to do when we are dealing with finances, is we have to take care of the day-to-day stuff first. Second of all, our own priorities like retirement. And then and only then do we start worrying about paying for the kids' college, because you can borrow money to go to college. You cannot borrow money to retire. my favorite kind of double duty tool for saving for retirement and for college is the Roth IRA. And the reason that I like it is because you can put money into a Roth IRA if you have earnings, qualified earnings. You don't get a big tax break on the deposit, but the earnings in retirement are tax-free. But the cool thing about the Roth IRA is you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want, at any time, for any reason, and there will be no taxes or penalties on the contribution portion. So let's just say you're a couple who just had a kid. The two of you, if you max out your Roth IRA contributions each year and you put in, let's just say, $6,000 each year for 18 years, well, that's going to be $200,000 that you can pull out at any time for any reason, including paying for college. And if not, it serves as a really nice rainy day fund in the meantime, and then also gives you a great base on which to retire. So Roth IRAs are actually the first way that especially younger families who are struggling with just covering day-to-day expenses, if they do want to save some money for college, start with the Roth IRA first.
So and Go ahead.
I was going to
say, so the Roth IRA is more advantageous to, in this situation, than a traditional IRA, correct?
Absolutely, because with a traditional IRA, if you pull it out, you're going to pay taxes on the withdrawal, and if you're under 59 and a half and you don't have a qualified reason for pulling that money out, you're also going to pay a 10% penalty on it. And so, unless you're in a very high income tax bracket, the Roth IRA is a much better saving vehicle than the regular IRA.
Okay. Well, you know, we also see that grandparents, for example, and aunts and uncles will tend to purchase savings bonds for young people as they're born and growing up. And some folks are also using that as an investment vehicle themselves. Are savings bonds a good value down the road?
They were not until about 6 months ago. And especially a particular type of savings bond called Series I savings bonds. And the I stands for inflation. And these are issued by the United States government. They're about as safe as an investment as you can possibly have. And because they're tied to inflation, when we see prices rising and the consumer price index rising, so does the interest rate on these Series I savings bonds. And this is actually the best investment out there right now for just about anybody. They have the interest rate changes every May and November, and it can go as low as zero. But right now, it pays 7.12% on an annualized basis, and that interest, Rick, is exempt from state income taxes. So for Wisconsin, that's almost like getting an 8% yield on a government-issued bond that is fairly liquid. You probably shouldn't put any money in this if you're going to need it within 12 months. But if you pull it out after 12 months, there's just a penalty of 3 months' worth of interest on the withdrawal. And if you leave it in there for at least 5 years, there's no penalty to pull it out whatsoever. The downside of these bonds is you can't buy them in an IRA or a Roth IRA. You have to buy them outside of a retirement account. And you can only buy $10,000 per person per year. So even a couple can only buy $20,000 total per year, but they're just a great way to get a really fantastic yield on a super safe investment. And if you want to find out more about these, you can go to the government's website. It's treasurydirect.gov. treasurydirect.gov. And just to be forewarned, I've sent a lot of people to this website to buy these bonds because we can't purchase them for our clients. Obviously, they have to purchase them on their own. But we've had some people who said, yep, I navigated that site pretty well. I got the money transferred and I bought the bonds. It was a Saturday afternoon. It was no problem. We've also had clients who are head of IT departments at huge organizations say, I'm sorry, Kevin, I spent 3 days trying to navigate that website. I couldn't do it, so I just gave up. So that's another downside to those bonds, but they're called Series I savings bonds. And if you have any cash, it's just set aside right now, or you're saving for college. It's a really nice, safe way to accumulate a higher interest rate right now and hopefully help fight inflation in the future.
Financial advisor Kevin McKinley is here as we continue our discussion on smart money choices on Route 51. When we return, we'll talk about college funds a little bit more, retirement planning, and much more. While we're talking about money, we just have a few seconds to ask for your support during WPR's Winter Member Drive. You count on WPR to make a difference in your day to help you learn about things that matter, like money management. Now we ask that you support the radio that you rely on. Make your difference now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want.
Go on, take the money and run.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, welcoming listeners of the West Side. Financial advisor Kevin McKinley is our guest today on the program. We'd like to hear from you. If you have a question about money management, what are your personal finance questions? Call us at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Money has tremendous power over us as people, and being too much in debt can really cause stress, significant stress. Kevin, how much debt is too much debt?
Well, there's no such thing really as too much debt. It depends on the person's situation. And again, debt can be a very effective tool. If we had to save up money to pay for college or to pay for a home or even to pay for a car completely, most of us would never be able to afford it. And especially at a time when prices are rising so much and they're rising faster than savings rates on safe investing. So there are good kinds of debt and there are bad kinds of debt. Good debt is usually a mortgage, and lenders will helpfully not allow you to take on too much debt. They usually like to keep it at about a third of your gross income, and that's a number that I like to see for debt, is trying to add up your gross monthly income and keep all of your debt payments, car loans, mortgages, credit card payments, student loan payments, whatever, try to keep that under a third of your gross income. So if you're, let's say you're as a household, you're bringing in $6,000 per month. You want to keep your total debt payments down to about $2,000 of that $6,000 gross amount.
Well, let's face it. Credit cards are really quite easy to get. We get the credit card mailings all the time. But some people will have three, four, sometimes more credit cards, and they max them out, and they're swimming in debt, credit card debt, which can be extremely expensive. What's the best way to solve that issue?
Take the credit card debt and walk into your local bank or credit union and say, hey, this is more debt than I would like, and it's more a higher interest rate than I would like. Do you have some kind of loan that I can not only extend out the term in terms of paying off the debt, but also lower the interest rate? And that might be, you know, as dramatic as bringing the interest rate down from 18% to 12% and then putting it on a five-year consumer loan. Now, the bad news about that is that the first thing they're going to do is look at your credit score. And because you've accumulated a lot of debt on credit cards, your credit score isn't going to be very good. But it still is a good way to get to start managing the debt payments and get that paid off. And then please, if you get yourself in that situation, tear up the credit cards, close out the accounts if you have to, but put some kind of self-imposed limit on yourself so that you don't go back in and then charge the credit cards back up again and tack that on top of the fixed consumer loan that you just were lucky enough to get from the bank or the credit union.
You mentioned the credit score. Credit scores really can have a major impact on finances, getting a loan at a good rate and so on, or getting the loan at all. And we see on television quite a bit all these commercials about credit card debt. We're going to give you a better credit score. What really is a way that people can take action and to improve that credit and that credit score?
Never miss a payment. do whatever you can. You know, if you need to sell your sofa to come up with enough money just to make the minimum payment, that's the first and the most important thing. The second thing is try not to let the balances of the available credit get above about 30 to 35% of the available credit on the credit card. For instance, if you have a credit limit of $10,000, you probably don't want that balance to get above $3,000 to $3,500. So try to cap that and pay that off whenever you possibly can. And then finally, don't take out too much debt, because if you have a lot of accounts opened up and high balances, that's really going to ding your credit score. The good news is that the credit scores are so responsive to changes, for better or for worse, is that it only takes a few months of paying debt down and handling it responsibly before you boost your credit score. And so if you're running into that kind of a problem, and it is a problem, you know, credit scores not only affect if you can get a loan, but what the terms of the loan will be, but they can also affect, you know, your homeowner's insurance, your auto insurance, et cetera. Even, you know, there are certain jobs where if you have a bad credit score, that can preclude you getting the job, because they found that people with poor credit scores haven't been good employees, or they've created a risk in terms of theft or fraud or something like that. Might not be fair, but that's the way that some systems work. And so a good credit score really can help you out in life. And it's one of the big things that you actually can control. And so it's a good idea to try to keep that up, especially above average. And 720 right now is probably about average. If you're young and you're in debt and you're in the 600s or something like that, don't worry about it. Most of us were in that situation at one point when we started out. But as you get older, you earn more money and you make more responsible decisions, it's easier to get your score back up to a more acceptable level.
Okay. So let's flip the coin. What's the best thing you can do right now with your earnings or savings?
If you have that kind of debt out, like credit card debt, that is where your first dollar should go after you've set up a 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses, rainy day funds. Because when you pay a credit card down, not only do you save yourself the interest cost, which can, again, can be anywhere from 12 to 24%, and that's a guaranteed instantaneous rate of return that you get by paying that credit card down. So that's the best thing to do first and foremost with the money, is pay any kind of double-digit interest rate debt down as quickly as possible. After that, then you can start saving money for retirement. And as I mentioned, the Roth IRA is the first way to go for that. If you do have an at-work retirement plan, like a 401k or a 403b, that is a great thing to do after you have maxed out your Roth IRA contributions for your family. And especially if you have a significant income. And by significant, I mean $50,000 to $60,000 or more for a single filer, and $100,000 or more for a married couple filing jointly. Because when you save into a pre-tax plan like that 401k or that 403b, you cut your income taxes by about 25 cents for every dollar you put into the pre-tax plan. So if you can put $10,000 into a 401k plan, for instance, this year, your income tax bill will automatically be reduced somewhere between $2,000 and $2,500 for that particular year. And you didn't spend that money. You didn't donate that money. You just basically paid yourself by saving it into your own 401k. And for people, we get a lot of, you know, responsible people, especially younger people, come to us and say, I don't know, should I be saving every single penny? Should I be, you know, living in the basement and waiting to die? How do I know if I'm saving enough? And can I actually do something that's not, you know, completely constructive and responsible with my money, like take a trip? And I just talked about this with a 30-something person who had a really nice career and a good income. She's kind of wondering. She's like, I want to be responsible, but I also don't want to just, you know, miss out on life. And so I said, okay, pay off all of your credit card debt first. Second of all, get that 3 to 6 months living expenses set aside. Third, max out your Roth. And fourth, try to save at least 10% of your income into your pre-tax plan at work, like your 401k or your 403b. And if you're doing that, that's the time then that you can do things like take a trip, or you know, buy some furniture that, you know, isn't the most practical purchase, but if you can pay cash for it, you can do it without putting it on the credit card. That's a great way to balance out, you know, the short-term needs and wants, and also still make sure that you're not 68 years old and saying, oh, I guess I should have saved a dollar for retirement because now I don't have anything.
Well, there are still a lot of people that I know that would have a lot of their earnings and savings in a traditional savings account at the bank. Now, is that still a good opportunity when we have these other options like the Roth and other things that you've been talking about? Is that a wise place to keep your money if it's a significant amount?
Well, the Roth IRA and IRAs and 401ks are really just jars. They're empty vessels in which we deposit money, and then once it gets into that vessel, we choose what kind of investment we're going to put into it. Savings account is really a great way for that 3 to 6 months of rainy day funds for it. That's really where that should be. And again, those Series I savings bonds we talked about earlier, that's another place to kind of park cash for it too. One of the big mistakes that people are making right now is because interest rates on safe investments and liquid investments like short-term CDs have been so low, is that many people in an attempt to reach out and get more yield, they're putting money into things like bond mutual funds and other more risky investments. And what they've just found out in the last 4 to 6 weeks, is that those investments were not nearly as safe as they imagined, because when interest rates rise, bond fund values can fall. And because bond funds only pay a little bit of interest rate anyway, it doesn't take a big decline before you've given up all the interest rate that you have. So I don't like investments where people say, hey, I want a middle of the road. I want something kind of moderate. I'd rather have you say, hey, I'm almost like a barbell strategy where I've got a bunch of money that's really safe. It doesn't make much, but it doesn't go down at all. And then my long-term investments, that's where I go for stock funds and other mutual funds that might have a lot more volatility, but also have a lot more potential for long-term growth. So don't try to straddle it. It's kind of like when you invest, you're trying to keep money safe but earn more yield on it. It's kind of like you're standing on a dock at the lake and the boat is right next to the dock, and you put one foot on the boat, and just as you do that, the boat kind of starts drifting out away from you, and all of a sudden you're going to start doing an Olympic gymnast splits and you have to choose one or the other. You have to either jump into the boat or stay on the dock.
That's a great picture. Thanks for that, Kevin. You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest today is financial advisor Kevin McKinley. If you'd like to join the conversation with questions about personal finance, call 800-780-9742. Again, that number is 800-780-9742. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Okay, Kevin, we're talking about retirement. We're just kind of landing right in there right now. What are some of the best ways for folks to prepare for retirement?
It comes back to analyzing spending. When you're trying to figure out your financial independence, I bet 6 different software programs that we try to use to say, well, can you retire? And if so, how much can you spend in retirement? And where should it be invested? But it still comes down to a very simple concept that, because I'm not the brightest person in the world, I had to simplify this in a way that I could understand it so that I could explain it to people and that hopefully they would understand it, is when you're figuring out your financial situation, take your monthly expenses, okay? So let's just say you're spending, let's just say $4,000 in a typical month, which again, for the average retiring person in the Midwest, that's a pretty reasonable amount. Especially if you're not supporting 20-somethings or grandchildren or taking care of a parent or something. So let's say you're spending $4,000 per month. So take your savings and divide your total savings by $4,000. And that's how many months your savings will last. So if you have, let's just say you have $400,000 in your retirement accounts, your savings, 403B, whatever. Just take that and say, hey, I'm going to need to spend $4,000 of that every single month. So this will last me 100 months, which is, 8 years or so. When you do that, it shows you, first of all, that by reducing your expenses, it allows your savings to last longer. And of course, for most of us, we have Social Security available, and some of us have a pension available too. So then you can pile that amount on top of whatever the spending amount is. So if you say, hey, I figured out that based on the amount of months I'm going to live, I need to have $400,000 because I'm going to spend, let's just say, $4,000 per month. Well, you can pile on the $2,000 you might get from Social Security, and so you can effectively spend $6,000 per month in retirement in that situation. But But again, it just shows the value of saying, hey, the fewer dollars amount I spend now and in retirement, the sooner I can retire, the less risk I need to take in my investing, and the more likely it is that I'll have a very happy, stress-free retirement.
The light bulb just went off. Thanks.
Some people, Rick, when I give them that figure and say, hey, take the amount of money you have, divide it by the amount of months you're going to live, that's how much you can spend this month, and then repeat. Some people are ecstatic about it, and other people need to go lie down for a minute.
That's interesting. Okay. What about people who haven't saved for retirement in their early years, and now they're in their late 30s, 40s, or even their 50s, and realizing there's no safety net? Is it too late for them?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And in fact, that's actually the scenario that's most likely. You're very fortunate if you had both the motivation and the resources to start saving money in your 20s or 30s for retirement. It's great. It's one of the keys to becoming financially independent is save a little early rather than trying to save a lot later. But no, most other people have reach the 30s and 40s with very little in their retirement savings. The good news is that what we do find is when people start saving in their 40s and 50s, they reduce their living expenses because they're putting more money into a Roth IRA or a 401k. And because they're used to living so cheaply, because they either haven't had the money or they've had to spend it on feeding kids and paying off mortgages and that, they adjust to a lifestyle in their 50s and 60s where they go, oh, well, you know, between a couple $1,000 a month from savings and a couple $1,000 from Social Security, this actually kind of covers the way that we need to live and want to live. And maybe they've paid off their mortgage, so they don't have that payment anymore. But no, definitely try to max out whatever you can save into your Roth IRA. And one thing is that you'll find is that when you do start saving automatically, like having money automatically deducted from your paycheck, is you really don't miss it and you readjust accordingly for it. And the cool thing about doing that automatically deduction is you can change it at any time. Usually if you say, hey, I'm just going to start saving 10% of my salary into a 401k and see if I starve to death by the end of the month. When you don't, then you go, oh, I kind of could make this great. And if something changes, you could say, oh, shoot, I have to do away with this savings, the money I was setting aside into my 401k, but at least you got something set aside in there. And we're very much creatures of habit and inertia, where once we get into a mode and a pattern, especially when we don't have to think about it, it really can work in our favor.
We're going to get to Social Security in just a little bit, but I did want to talk about something briefly before we head into the next break. Is the biggest item that people will be looking at purchasing in their lifetime is housing. The average family spends about 25% of their income on housing. What is the recommendation in taking out a mortgage? And better yet, tax-wise, is it better to keep a mortgage or pay off the house when that time comes?
Yeah, don't write the deciding on the mortgage with taxes in mind. I'd rather have you, it's more about liquidity. So when you buy a home, you should take out a 30-year mortgage and for hopefully 80% of the value of the home, because that will prevent you from having to pay private mortgage insurance. But you shouldn't spend every single penny that you have on the down payment to avoid private mortgage insurance. It's better to pay a little bit extra for that PMI than it is to use up every single penny for it, because you can always either build up enough equity in the home through appreciation in the value or paying down the mortgage or just contributing an emergency or a one-time injection into the mortgage payment to get back down below the PMI. But if you have, you know, a mortgage and no savings on it, and you run into some kind of financial problem, well, you're probably going to lose the house very quickly, and it's going to be very costly because you're going to have to sell it, probably pay a realtor's commission, et cetera. So get a 30-year mortgage, fixed rate, for 80% of the loan to value. And then pay that off as slowly as you can. And especially for people out there who have done this recently and have a 3 or 3.5% mortgage. Mortgage rates now are going up to close to 4%. And if we see a big escalation in interest rates, they might be hitting 5%. And so you'll be very happy that you borrowed money for 30 years at 3 or 3.5%. And yes, there is a potential tax break on that as well. And you just pay that off as slowly as possible. some responsible people, Rick, like to say, well, I'm just going to get a 15-year mortgage because I can not only get a lower interest rate, but I'll pay it off faster. Usually, if you run the numbers, you find that if you take out a 30-year mortgage, but then make the higher payment that the 15-year mortgage would have required, the higher monthly payment, you will still pay that mortgage off in about 15 and a half to maybe 16 years. But in the meantime, if something comes up where, so let's say interest rates rise a lot, you don't want to pay down this loan, or you have better use of the money, you can put your dollar monthly loan payment back down to the lower 30-year payment for it, and then it's more advantageous for it too. I think a lot of people who took mortgages out in the last year or two, and even now, this is still a very low interest rate time historically. I think a lot of people in the next 5 or 10 years are going to be very happy that they borrowed this money, and those who are paying it down faster than it needs to be, it feels good, but it might not be the wisest financial move.
You're listening to Route 51 with Kevin McKinley as our guest, a discussion about the making most of your money and making sound financial investments for the future. When we return, we'll talk about the stock market a little bit more, from investment apps to crypto and much more. Now we just want to take a few seconds to ask that you make an investment in the radio that you count on every single day. During WPR's Winter Member Drive, listener support is the largest source of funding for programs on Wisconsin Public Radio, like Route 51. That's important, especially right now. So we ask that you please make an investment in WPR with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thanks for that. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down. Thank God it's Friday night, and I just got
We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, welcoming listeners of the West Side. Kevin McKinley is our guest today on Route 51 as we continue our conversation about smart money management. You can join the conversation as well. Email ideas at WPR.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Kevin, more and more people are investing on their own instead of relying on expert advice like yours. Trading apps like Robinhood and Webull are attracting investors like never before, especially young people. How easy or smart is this form of investing?
Too easy and not smart. I've seen this with I have children in their teens and 20s, and I've seen this with their friends. It's not really investing in general. It's more gambling. And actually, gambling is okay if you can afford to lose the money. And it's not occupying your time, nor is it devastating. But buying some kind of stock because somebody on Reddit said that it's going to go up is not investing. I love the notion of do-it-yourself investing. It's never been a better time to actually invest on your own in terms of the platforms that companies like Schwab and Fidelity and Vanguard have for people to just go online and do it themselves and do it at what is a very low cost. It's extremely inexpensive compared to what it was 20 or 30 years ago to buy and sell mutual funds and stocks. The expenses of the mutual funds are very low. Buying a stock and holding it for a long time is a great way to get rich slowly. Trading stocks is akin to driving to a casino or going online at, you know, FanDuel or something like that and betting on if the Green Bay Packers are going to win or not. And so if it's a form of entertainment for you, I get it. It's great. It's also a really good way to get a painful, quick education about how quickly stock prices can move. And especially in just the last few weeks or so, a lot of those, you know, they're called meme stocks where they were just bantered about on the internet and, you know, friends texting each other and saying, hey, I bought $500 worth of this. Again, if you can afford to lose that $500 and see it go to zero, that's fine. I would rather that you put the money into something, you know, more constructive, but that's the only outlet in terms of, you know, it's an entertainment and it's not actual investing for it. The best thing to do is salt money aside in really boring things. And sadly, you're going to get older faster than you think you are. And you're going to be really glad that you salted that money aside today rather than trying to guess what the next meme stock was going to do.
Well, one of the things I'm still trying to wrap my head around is cryptocurrency. You know, you hear all this stuff about Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, and similar types of cryptos, extremely popular right now, again, especially with younger investors. We're even seeing celebrities endorsing them. What's up with crypto? What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's really what you're doing with, you know, people use the phrase Ponzi scheme to talk about things, but really all forms of wealth are some form of Ponzi scheme in the sense that you're trying to trade this for a good and hopefully sell this asset to someone at a higher price at some point down the road. The bad news about, you know, crypto and Bitcoin and things like that is that it's still in a highly unregulated environment and there's really no tangible value to it whatsoever. It's not like even buying a bond that's going to pay you interest or a stock that's going to pay a dividend or part ownership of a company. You're only buying this and hoping that you can then turn around and sell it to what is known as a greater fool. You want to sell it to someone who is hopefully dumber than you are and willing to pay a higher price for it than you are. And again, if you say, hey, I'm going to put $5,000 into Bitcoin or some other kind of crypto, and you can see that $5,000 go to zero and not have it affect you emotionally or financially or psychology, that's fine. But as an investment, it's the exact same type of thing as Beanie Babies, as the dot-com era, pets.com that we went through, you know, 20 or 25 years ago. It's really going to be difficult if and when this implodes for people to say, oh, shoot, that I did that for the wrong reasons and now I lost all of my money into it.
We have a caller from Wausau. Steve, you're on the air with us. Welcome to Route 51. What's your question?
I just had a comment. Kevin's right all the way is do a sheet of paper and list all your expenses so you know where your money's going. And then my other comment is I had a mentor 1971, I started my first job, and he said, four things you should give up, and you will, each one is worth $400,000 in 40 years based on whatever time of year it is, interest rates on this and that. With the four things he said, never drink, never smoke, always carry your own lunch, and always drive a used car. And in fact, the company I was with always gave us brand new cars, and he chose not to take that. He took the mileage instead, and then he started buying things like his own airplanes and things like that. So I think he was great.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call.
Yeah, the good news, Steve, is if for people who do choose to drink a lot, smoke a lot, and eat out a lot, they're going to have a relatively short lifespan, so they don't need that much money to retire on. But yeah, otherwise, that's a really good advice. And we've had clients who've come to us and said, I not only have tracked every expense every single month, people make fun of me and my family for it, but I went back and went through my parents' papers when they died and just was throwing things out. And I realized that my folks did this in the 1950s. And I've even had a situation where someone said, I actually got some grandparents. Kind of an heirloom box, and they had, you know, still marking down eggs Friday, 10 cents in 1908 or something like that. And it really is important to track those expenses so that you see what you can eliminate and where things are going. The cool thing is, if you're in a committed relationship with someone, there is another person who is dying to tell you about all the dumb things you spend your money on. And so if you want to find out what can be reduced, just hand your spending list over to that person and say, what do you think I should cut back on here? And they will be more than happy to tell you what that spending items are.
Now, that's good advice. Now, let's talk a little bit about Social Security. You can start to claim Social Security at 62 or at full retirement at 67. There's a maximum monthly benefit that kicks in at 70. What is the best time to claim Social Security, or what's the best way to maximize your benefit?
That's a tricky question for retirees. The good news is a lot of people who are still working are afraid that their Social Security is going to be lost. And we're currently running a surplus of Social Security that's somewhere around $2.5 trillion that's invested into Treasury bonds and earns interest. In fact, I think last year those bonds earned about $70 billion with a B dollars that were contributed to that Social Security surplus. Now, because we've had a lot of people leaving the workforce in the last year or so, there have been more people claiming Social Security and fewer people paying in for it. So that surplus has started to get tapped into, and the projections are difficult to nail down. The surplus will probably be used up somewhere in around the next 10 to 15 years or so. But the projections are, even at that point, that workers paying in will still cover about 75 to 80% of the projected benefits. So I'm not as worried about Social Security as some people are. I do think that there will be some steps taken to shore it back up, and just very lightly increasing the tax and very slightly decreasing the benefit that will make it whole again. When you're talking about taking Social Security, the median age at which people take it, Rick, is somewhere around 63. So after the first year of eligibility, about half of Social Security recipients have already claimed their check. Some of that is because people need to do it, but others just say, it just feels good. I had a client who was in very good shape. He came to me and said, hey, what's the benefit of waiting to 70 to take Social Security? And I said, ran the numbers. I said, you're probably looking about an extra $100,000 over your retirement. He said, great. He walked out and he walked over to the Social Security office and claimed it. And when we checked back in with each other, I said, no offense, but why did you do that? And he said, well, I just wanted to know what the cost was. But he said, I've figured out, you know, I told him actually that the break-even age for waiting to take Social Security is usually right around 80 or so. So in other words, if you are going to wait to take Social Security, you have to live to be 80 before it makes sense. He said, I've been to a lot of funerals for people younger than 80 and even younger than 62. He said, I've been told my whole life that Social Security is not going to be there. And by taking it right now, it feels really good to me to live off of this money that just seems to trickle out of the sky, rather than tapping into my savings and watching my investments slowly decline because I'm waiting for this kind of two in the bush rather than taking the bird in the hand right now. So I think people should wait as long as they can stand. There's some good planning opportunities between retirement and initiating Social Security, but otherwise take it. And I've never had a person who said to me a year or two later, say, boy, I really regret taking that Social Security. One guy who's very astute financial manager, client of mine, he ran the numbers and called me back and said, yeah, I took Social Security and I just got my first check. I said, okay, how do you feel about that? And he said, it feels so good.
That's great. Many of us learn our money habits from our parents. You know, we copy what they do a lot of the times. You wrote a book about this. What are your thoughts about teaching children responsible money habits, and where does that all begin?
Yeah, start saving at an early age for them. I don't care if it's a dollar a day or $25 a month. Start putting money aside, because when kids become teenagers, they figure out that their parents have made this very small sacrifice for a very long-term huge reward, and they adopt that strategy. He said, my parents started saving for me at this age, and so that kind of dawned on me that, oh, that's what you do. And even if it's just, you know, you've only accumulated a few hundred dollars for it, it's not so much the financial benefit of it, it's more the aspect of saying, hey, we started putting money aside for you right away. It's also talking about wants and versus needs. It's saying, yep, we'd like to, you know, buy those clothes for you, but you know, these shoes are $200 and they're no better than shoes that are $50. And so we're going to get you the shoes that are $50 for it. And Rick, you know, you've got children and now a grandchild yourself. One of the great things about this generation in general is this could be the least materialistic generation of young adults that we've seen since the Depression. And I think that's going to serve them very well as time goes by.
Kevin, one last piece of advice before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Great. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer in for Shereen Seward. Glad to have listeners of the West Side along for the ride today. I'd like to thank our guest, Kevin McKinley. Our producers are Joy Ratchkramer, Shereen Seward, and Kate Springer. Joy is also our on-air producer today. Special music today from ABBA, The Flying Lizard, Steve Miller Band, NSYNC, Sarah Vaughan, and the OJs. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. As we close today's program, we ask that you consider making a gift to WPR during our winter memo drive. You can do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thanks for that. Join us next week for another fascinating ride along Route 51. Until then, we're headed out of town.